Abington Health supports WHYY and understands that a lung cancer diagnosis can turn your world upside down. Abington Health's lung cancer team is dedicated to putting your mind and your world at ease. With advanced diagnostics like endobronchial ultrasound and important treatment options like stereotactic body radiosurgery, plus minimally invasive surgery and genomic testing of tumor tissue, Abington Health can create a treatment plan just for you. Learn more at abingtonhealth.org.
New Jersey's Supreme Court ruled today that the state cannot be forced to increase contributions to the pension funds for public workers. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Joining me now with a look at the implications for public employees and their unions, as well as for taxpayers and for lawmakers, is John Reitmeier, NJ Spotlight budget and public finance writer. John, thanks for joining us once again on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
First off, what specifically did the court find today?
So the court ruled that a series of escalating payments that the state had pledged to make in a 2011 law that was passed by the Democratic legislature and signed by Governor Christie, a Republican, cannot be enforced as a contractual right of the employees. So it doesn't mean that the state doesn't have the right to make those higher payments that are designed to correct years of underfunding of the pension system. It just means that they're not forced into making those payments. And the reason that became an issue in recent years, as the state's economy hasn't grown with the force that Governor Christie once projected, he said the state just simply can't afford to make the larger payments. And so the public worker union sued the state to enforce the larger payments, and that's what brought out the ruling today.
And indeed, Christie acted to cut the state's payment last year amid a surprising tax revenue shortfall. Though, isn't it true that the court today still obligated the state government to pay retirees the pensions that they'd been promised?
That's absolutely right, and we should be clear. So the ruling did not dispute that public workers are entitled to a pension upon their retirement, and no one should get the impression that the state won't be able to make its pension payments to beneficiaries in the next year or even several years on out. What this case hinged on was payments that the state had promised to make to pay down debt that's built up in the system based on prior administrations and the current one not making the full payments that actuaries say the state should be putting aside every year to not only pay current benefits, but those that are going to go to people who haven't retired yet.
Public workers and their unions are predictably not pleased with today's finding. Realistically, what options do they have?
There's the question of appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it'll take a while for that whole U.S. Supreme Court appeal process to unfold, and that may not make sense from either a timing perspective or from the state budget cycle. They're going to still lean heavily on Democratic legislative leaders to make the payments that are called for in the law, even if the court has found that the law is not enforceable under the state constitution. So they're going to put a lot of pressure. And remember, we have assembly elections. All 80 seats in the lower house are up for grabs in November. And so there'll be pressure on lawmakers. And the unions are typically influential and have a lot of money to donate to assembly candidates.
Does today's finding have implications for budget talks moving forward or for taxpayers?
I would say yes and yes. There was a news conference this afternoon with some labor leaders and Senate President Steve Sweeney from Gloucester Township. Sweeney's position is basically that they can't now negotiate a budget off of the proposal that Christie made back in February, a $33.8 billion proposed spending plan. It would put $1.3 billion into the pension system, which would actually be a record one-year payment for the state of New Jersey. But the law that was agreed to in 2011 calls for a $3.1 billion payment. And so Democrats are being a little close to the vest right now in terms of how they're going to get to that larger $3.1 billion contribution. We know they want to introduce and pass a tax hike on income earned over $1 million. That's going to bring in about $600 to $700 million a year. So they're going to need another billion from somewhere to get up to that larger payment that they want to make. There was some hope about a month ago that there would be a negotiated budget with Christie working with the Democratic leaders. Right now, that doesn't look like it's going to be the case. The Constitution requires a balanced budget in place on July 1. New Jersey did have a shutdown I guess almost a decade ago under Governor Corzine. We'll see what happens this year.
John, thanks for bringing us up to date.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's John Reitmeier, NJ Spotlight budget and public finance writer on Newsworks Tonight. As incidents and protests across the country suggest, America cannot quite call itself a post-racial society just yet. Still, if you look at voting patterns in recent elections, it's hard not to see some signs of progress. On today's That's History, New York University historian Jonathan Zimmerman discusses the history of cross-racial voting with WHYY's Chris Satullo.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here as always.
In previous episodes of That's History, recently we've talked about events in Ferguson and Baltimore and elsewhere, and talked about how they sort of explode the notion that America has reached the status of a post-racial society. But in some recent electoral results, you see some more encouraging data, if not, you know, proving that we're post-racial, at least that it's not hopeless.
Yes, we are not post-racial. We're divided around race. And yet, mayoral elections, including the recent one in this town, the primary election, suggest that actually, when it comes to the way that they vote, Americans are becoming, if you will, less racially minded in the sense that they're more likely to cross racial lines when they get into the voting booth.
Okay, so in the recent Philadelphia Democratic primary, which in Philadelphia pretty much constitutes the mayoral election, Jim Kenney won with a majority, not just a plurality, of the vote in a six-person field, including a candidate, the African-American State Senator Anthony Williams, who, when the election began, was regarded as the clear frontrunner. And Jim Kenney actually got more of the black vote than Anthony Williams.
Yeah, they pretty much split it, which is astonishing when you think of the fact that our first African-American mayor, Wilson Good, in 1983, when he defeated Frank Rizzo, took 97% of the African-American vote of the city. And now we have Anthony Williams getting about half of it.
So Jim Kenney wins in this majority-minority city with a majority of the vote, coming out of 16 years where the city had had reasonably successful African-American mayors. But let's look back in history. When and where was the first African-American mayor elected?
Well, it was in Cleveland, Ohio, and it was Carl Stokes in 1967. That same year, actually, in Gary, Indiana, a guy named Richard Hatcher also became mayor. They were the two first big city African-American mayors. But it's interesting to look back at that time to see just how radical this was. Cleveland at the time was 37% African-American. It was not a majority black town. And so in order to get elected, Stokes had to allay white anxieties in ways that I think 50 years later some of us might find astonishing. He actually gave a speech the first time he ran, which was in 65, saying that if he won, he wouldn't fire all the whites in city government. Basically, I'm not going to follow this very common prejudice that's associated with my group, and I've got to say that directly in order to allay fears about my group.
Stokes begins not a wave, but there are African-American mayors elected in various major American cities in the next few years.
Indeed, and here's kind of the bitter historic irony is, thanks to the civil rights struggle, you have for the first time African-Americans empowered to vote and African-Americans running to be mayors. But when they start to succeed in the 1970s is right when our cities begin their long swoon, where you have white flight and you have deindustrialization and infrastructure and schools start to crumble. And so inevitably, the mayor is blamed for all of that. And in many cities, starting in the 70s, that mayor turns out to be a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Maynard Jackson, who was the first African-American mayor of Atlanta, which has since had a long series of them, he famously said that the problem with being an African-American mayor is you have to deal with white anxieties and black expectations. So the whites are afraid of you because lots of them don't think a black person should be mayor. But the blacks, who up until now have been so disenfranchised and disempowered, they expect that once we have a black mayor that suddenly everything's going to be peachy keen. And given all of the structural inequalities that cities inherited, that was just completely implausible. There was no way that Maynard Jackson was going to transform Atlanta in the way that some of his constituents expected.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.
Historian Jonathan Zimmerman speaking with WHYY's Chris Satullo. Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Senate Republicans are warning Democratic Governor Tom Wolf that they will not allow him to keep Marcus Brown in place as acting state police commissioner now that the Senate has rejected his nomination. Senate Majority Leader Jay Corman says he won't make threats before he knows how Wolf plans to deal with Brown, but that the governor needs to respect the confirmation process and select a new nominee. Billionaire investor Carl Icahn is accusing an Atlantic City casino union of using lies, intimidation, and threats to get companies to contribute to a pension fund that he calls, quote, critically underfunded. He made the comments today after members of Local 54 of the Unite Here union went to his Fifth Avenue offices in New York City, delivering a letter saying the casino's benefit cuts are not okay. Pennsylvania House Speaker Mike Terzai is making the case against imposing a new severance tax on gas drilling in the state, warning it may cost jobs and harm the industry. Terzai is attacking a proposal by Governor Tom Wolf to increase taxes on the industry to generate new money for education. Partly cloudy, 83 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. There's a chance of a stray shower this evening, otherwise clearing skies, low overnight around 67 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny, Wednesday's high in the mid-80s. The call, hazy, hot, and humid for Thursday and Friday, high both days, 92. Saturday, partly sunny with a chance of showers, high around 88. Still ahead, a Philadelphia woman is planning the wedding of her dreams at a New Jersey winery. But state law bans weddings at many wineries.
If we can't do weddings, would you rather us have wine festivals every single weekend that we're permitted to do, and we don't know if 200 people are coming or 1,000 people are coming?
RSVP regrets only as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Barbara Brodsky Suites at Lincoln All Medical Center support WHYY and offer a new option in private overnight hospital accommodations. Each suite features a private living and dining area and personalized amenities for a tranquil and home-like environment that complements Lincoln All's clinical care. With concierge services and gourmet dining options, the Barbara Brodsky Suites are a novel alternative to traditional hospital accommodations. To take a virtual tour, mainlinehealth.org/Brodsky.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The clock is ticking on a $25,000 challenge. We only have until June 15th to receive 1,000 pledges. If we can reach this goal, an anonymous donor will give WHYY an additional $25,000 in memory of Hubert J.P. Schumacher. Every pledge counts, so we need to hear from you right now at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Penn Museum supports WHYY. In 1940, Penn Museum excavated objects from the burial site of an ancient Panamanian chief, unearthing golden plaques, precious stones, painted ceramics, and more. In Beneath the Surface, Life, Death, and Gold in Ancient Panama, open now at the Penn Museum. Learn the story behind the excavation, the artifacts uncovered, and the mysterious Coclé people who lived, died, and buried their dead more than 1,000 years ago. Details at penn.museum.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The Lion King remains one of the most popular stage musical shows on Broadway, and also in Hamburg, Tokyo, Madrid, and Brisbane. The national tour of the show is currently playing in Philadelphia, and Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro reports on the state of things in the show's Pride Lands these days.
Here in Swahili is a riff I suspect just about all of us will recognize, and almost none of us can sing. That's the stirring voice of Tashidi Manya, and those are the opening words of Disney's blockbuster musical The Lion King, which comes from the company's blockbuster movie of the same name. Tashidi Manya plays the baboon and truth-teller named Rafiki in the national tour of the show, now at the Academy of Music, and even there, where garbling acoustics for amplified musicals turn the lyrics of high-pitched songs into goop, it doesn't seem to matter. Many of the songs are in the heads of the audience, and I could hear the purr of young kids around me softly singing the indelible tunes by Elton John and Tim Rice. The Lion King is one of those shows that's its own big brand. And I'm happy to report that the circle of life remains intact in two ways. On the stage, where the animals portrayed by the National Tour's actors move through a story about nature's chain, and in the audience, where many generations come together to watch. The 1997 show is as magical today as it was then, when it went on to win a Best Musical Tony Award and five others. They could have created a seventh Tony for most effective use of theater aisles. Julie Taymor's staging shows off her eye-popping animal costumes and puppets from the start, as much of the cast walks through the Academy of Music and onto the stage, a parade signaling that an unusual and special spectacle will be happening here. It may be less unusual these days, but it's still special. It's the circle of life. The stage musical of The Lion King runs at the Academy of Music through June 14th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
As New Jersey wineries win more awards and kudos and find themselves less often the butt of jokes, some say new legislation is needed to ensure that they can stay in business. Many wineries are on preserved farmland, preventing them from being able to host weddings or other events, as WHYY's Katie Heiler reports.
Janica Brooks is planning an elegant, rustic wedding, standing inside the cavernous tasting room at Willow Creek Winery in West Cape May. She says she and her fiancé, Matt, aren't having one of those cookie-cutter weddings.
So what I'm doing is a lot of candles and flowers and rather than the chalkboard and, you know, more the DIY sort of mentality.
The room's five glass chandeliers and plush leather couches contrast nicely with its barn-like structure. It's a beautiful space, perfect for the couple's 200-guest wedding. Willow Creek can't exactly call it a wedding. The contract the couple signed specifically calls it a winery event. This is because Willow Creek's tasting room is on land that has been preserved by the state of New Jersey for agricultural purposes. The question of whether weddings, birthdays, and other life celebratory events should be allowed to take place on preserved farmland has yet to be answered. And it all hinges on whether New Jersey wine growers can demonstrate that these events are critical to the sale of New Jersey wine. Chances are you won't easily find wine from the Garden State on the shelf of your local liquor store or favorite restaurant wine list. New Jersey is a relative newcomer to the fiercely competitive wine business, so the state's 50 boutique wineries rely on getting people to visit the farm to taste the product. And Kevin Celli, farm director and winemaker at Willow Creek, says weddings help them do that.
If you have a wedding here at our farm and 200 people come here, there's a good possibility that 190 of them would have never come to your farm, might have never even come to your community, let alone came in, had the opportunity to sample our wines and also leave with our wines.
20 New Jersey wineries are located on preserved farmland. The state has preserved more than 200,000 acres on farms, buying the development rights to the land and stipulating that it can only be used for agriculture. The State Agricultural Development Committee, or SADC, is the agency that determines which activities are allowed to take place on preserved farms, and it says weddings aren't one of them.
And my statement to them was, if we can't do weddings, then we're more than allowed and more than permitted to have a wine festival every weekend till the cows come home. We can do that, 100%. So to me it was, what would you rather me do? Would you rather me have an event that brings 200 people to my farm that might have never come there? Or would you rather us have wine festivals every single weekend that we're permitted to do, and we don't know if 200 people are coming or 1,000 people are coming?
So Celli and some other winery owners helped legislators craft a bill that would allow celebratory events under New Jersey's Right to Farm Act. The bill passed in the Assembly 70-1. Then Governor Christie vetoed it and replaced the text of the bill with the concept of a pilot study that would be overseen by the SADC.
The focus of our pilot program will be to listen, learn, collect as much information as we can. You know, we're approaching this pilot program with no preconceived ideas.
Hope Gruzlovic is a spokesperson for the SADC. She says that as part of the pilot study, wineries are now allowed to conduct a pre-approved set of events on preserved land. They must obey all local ordinances, and at least 51% of their profits must come from the sale of New Jersey wine. Once every 3 months, the SADC will collect information from the wineries.
We're using this 44-month period to learn as much as we can about wineries, about special occasion events and the role they play in agricultural operation, how they interrelate, how they affect the winery's bottom line, so that when the pilot program ends in March 2018, we'll be better informed about wineries in general. And it certainly could influence how wineries are dealt with in the future for beyond preserve farms.
And that last part is really critical. Not only did the vetoed bill fail to pave the way for weddings on preserved farms, it opened up the door for a ruling that could affect all wineries in New Jersey. Currently, it's still legal to hold these events on land that has not been preserved, but the outcome of the pilot study could change all that. A blanket regulation that restricts all wineries in New Jersey from hosting events could have major repercussions. The wine industry is the fastest-growing agricultural sector in New Jersey, and at a time when Atlantic City is struggling and the shore is still rebuilding from Superstorm Sandy, it's one of the state's biggest opportunities for tourism. Kevin Celli is not apologetic. He says his West Cape May winery needs to hold events in order to thrive. So if the SADC rules against him after the pilot program?
I will tell you that it'll be another fight for us.
For WHYY News, I'm Katie Heiler.
Finally this evening, it would be tempting to say that Calvin Duncan was caught red-handed, though it's more likely his hands were covered in black ink. The former Philadelphia Water Department employee has been sentenced to 2 years in prison for stealing and illegally selling more than $1.3 million worth of printer ink and toner cartridges. Duncan will also have to pay restitution of over $1.3 million. That's the amount the city paid for the cartridges. Over a six-year period, Duncan, who was in charge of ordering supplies for the department, made more than $500,000 selling the cartridges, and if that weren't enough, he shipped the ink using the water department's UPS shipping account. Well, with that, time to mail in tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Philadelphia has the distinction of being the only city to have a professional soccer fan club before it even had a team. That story is now the subject of a documentary, and we'll have a preview of its screening in Philadelphia tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and offers special programming on the second Saturday of every month, with hands-on activities that take place amidst scenic landscapes that showcase diverse woodland wildflowers. Saturday, June 13th, features guided walks and home gardening workshops. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hokesson, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants. More at mountcubacenter.org. That's mtcubacenter.org.